Good evening, and welcome to What a World. Celebrating diversity and loving it, this is Nevin Campanella bringing you a radio talk show that has no limits and bows to no one. From this microphone, we bring you guests who will lead you across those shadowy plains of forbidden knowledge.
And tonight's forbidden knowledge will come from Linda Moulton Howe. However, before getting to that knowledge, there are some historical noteworthy events that happened on this date of September 25th. Now, one of these major events was the first human blood transfusion. The recorded date for this is 1818. In other words, the doctor that did it actually published his results. It occurred from a patient who was suffering from postpartum hemorrhaging, and this doctor developed a syringe of sorts, took the blood from the husband, injected into the woman, and was successful. And secondly, today is also the birthday of the late Christopher Reeve, known for his acting career as Superman, but primarily for his unique courage and spiritual fortitude in facing the challenges of an accident which left his body paralyzed. We also have some noteworthy news items to report on this date. Guess who said in 1998, quote, "We are all going to have to rethink how we deal with this because there are all these competing values. Without any kind of editing function or gatekeeping function, what does it mean to have the right to defend your reputation?" End quote. Well, that was none other than Hillary Clinton. But why does it resurface now on the Mad Drudge Report? Could it be something is in the works for government control of what is put on the Internet? My guess is that we will see more of this type of rhetoric in the weeks to come. Hold on to your free speech, if you can. Also in today's news, there was a report by the Washington Post of a major anti-war demonstration march on Washington, D.C. Apparently, this was the largest anti-war demonstration since the initial invasion of Iraq. The organizers expected 100,000 people, and those in favor of the war expected 10,000. Huge difference in terms of expectations, but we will really not know the actual figures until tomorrow. Now, for some news from what is happening in What a World Radio. Those who tuned in last week's show with reverse speech researcher David Oates, you know it was cut short by a loss of the phone connection to Australia. I have contacted David, and he will be on with us again to do a special broadcast of reverse speech regarding alien abductions and the spiritual aspects of reverse speech. And due to some radical changes in our broadcasting method, a new call-in system will be in place next week. Unfortunately, no call-ins will be possible on tonight's show. Also, beginning next Sunday, we're going to introduce a new segment to the show. It will feature a spot report by Charlotte King on earthquake predictions. Charlotte has been reporting physical symptoms associated with quakes and volcanic activity for the last 20 years and is most noted for her very accurate prediction of the Mount St. Helens eruption. Now, some of us attempt to predict what is going to happen on a planet, and then there are those rare individuals who roll up their shirt sleeves and go digging around the planet, attempting to investigate and report the many mysteries embedded in the Earth sciences. And that describes our guest for tonight, Linda Moulton Howe. Linda has a master's degree from Stanford University and is a recipient of the George Foster Peabody Award. The International Peabody Award is given for excellence in broadcasting and is the most prestigious award within the fields of broadcasting journalism. Linda is an extraordinary researcher who has devoted her documentary film, television, radio writing, and reporting career to productions concerning science, medicine, and the environment. And for those of you who have followed her career, you know her well from talk radio as the most talented quester of Earth Mystery News. Now, our little one-hour broadcast can never do justice to covering either her career or the fascinating mysteries she has tracked down, such as cattle mutilations. So I have asked Linda for an interview regarding her background and how she became involved with reporting Earth mysteries. It's a question that I and many others who have followed her amazing career have wanted to ask. Hi, Linda. Just how did you become involved in this business of Earth mysteries?
After I left in high school and did the pageants that got me through college, I've always been in other parts of the United States. I didn't really return there, even though my parents stayed in the same house on 28th Street in Boise until they both passed on. So in my life, the house that I grew up in was the house that I knew my whole life.
How did you actually become involved in pageants? I mean, that's an absolutely fascinating concept to me.
For scholarships. My father worked for the state of Idaho, did not have a huge income or even a very much average income, and I wanted so badly to go to college and knew that the only way that I would be able to would be to get scholarship money, and that is one of the, I would say, one of the big pluses of the Miss America process, in that the scholarships that I earned at the city level, which was Miss Boise, and then the Idaho level, which was the state, and then in Atlantic City I also earned scholarships, and that money put me through the first 2 years of college at the University of Colorado, and then when I was already in the university, I received scholarship funding for, because I guess I was sort of a straight A or AB student, so I ended up getting scholarships there too. And then when I went to work for the senator and decided that I really wanted to go into reporting and documentary filmmaking, I applied to several universities that I really wanted to go to, including Stanford University in Palo Alto. And that university gave me the largest scholarship. It was a full scholarship to Stanford, and that's where I did my master's degree, making films for 2 years at the Stanford Linear Accelerator and at the Stanford Medical Center, because, again, my interest in everything in my life has always been in science, the environment, medicine. That's where my interests are. And when I was at Stanford, that's what I focused on. And when I left Stanford, I went directly into news in Los Angeles. I worked as a street reporter at KNBC, which is the Channel 4 local NBC side. And then I was asked if I would produce a studio program. It was called Inquiry. And we were copying an Edward R. Murrow TV show from the 50s and doing it in what essentially was the 70s. And I was going to Sacramento, field remotes in L.A., and we were doing a phone and cable line connection between Washington, D.C., and I was rotating every week. We were in a different location. And so right out of Stanford, I was working on national issues in live studio programs. And, in fact, the studio that I had to work in was Johnny Carson's. And
fantastic.
Oh, yeah. And he was, as everybody who I think knows, he was the greatest. And that studio was his. But for those of us who were doing daytime taping for broadcast later, some of us would be assigned that studio. There were a lot of studios, but I happened to be assigned to do the taping of my show. And talk about great training and discipline, which is, in a way, addressing your question, two of your questions, about being female in an all-male world.
Barrier.
And how difficult it was, but also how I managed to persist in the most difficult subjects of Earth mysteries that were politically unacceptable. In some ways, I think it goes back to those early days at KNBC, and this is what I wanted you to imagine. I had an office up on the fourth floor of a building that was separated by a very large quasi sort of parking lot, not for the general public, but just for executives and stars. And then the building that was on the other side of the parking lot, maybe the parking lot was 150, 200 feet wide, that was the main studio that had several studios in it, one of which was Johnny Carson's, and the videotape editing room. And every week, I had to produce my show live on tape with a host, with roll-ins from video. I had to be involved with editing and pre-edits. And
give us a time frame on that, Linda. What years are we talking about?
Let's see. I was producing Inquiry, I think, from 70 to 73-ish. And there was a huge sign in the editing door, and it said, anyone who is 5 minutes or more late will lose all videotape privileges for the day. And they weren't kidding. And I would go running across that parking lot, run into the door. The floors were always waxed. Everybody was always sliding. I would come around this corner, hanging on to one of the corners, breathless. I'm here. And when you start your first job in a box that big with those kinds of rules, and there was no slack, you either...
Lots of pressure.
Exactly.
One second, Linda. Aside from the first job, the anxiety, so on and so forth, you also started that job with a lot of popularity behind you. People had to know that you were going to work with Ms. Idaho behind you.
Well, but I was in Los Angeles, and it didn't count. There were a lot of girls in the Miss America pageant, and I was one of many. And I had the scholarship money had put me through school, but going to Los Angeles from Stanford, that part of my life meant zero. And in fact, because at that time of graduating and going to work in the early 70s in Los Angeles, the last thing that I wanted anyone to know then was that I had been a beauty pageant queen, because I wanted to be taken seriously. I was a reporter. I was working in studio shows. I didn't want anybody to think, oh, beauty pageant queen, therefore she must be stupid. Unfortunately, there are those kinds of links, and so it wasn't anything that I trafficked on. The thing that gave me the jobs that I had was the fact that I went to Stanford University and got a master's degree making films, and I went into the media world from Stanford, and that's what put me into the jobs that I had. But in television, you're only as good as your last show. There is no such thing as sitting on laurels. You have to keep pushing and pushing and pushing and moving into new ground constantly. And that is, I'm very grateful in some ways that I started in such big boxes with so much discipline, so much pressure. And as things evolved, I was married then, and my husband ended up 2 or 3 years after we had been in L.A. Both of us were producing. He went to Harvard, got an MBA, and he ended up working for Time Inc. that became Time Warner. And was
when is your anniversary date of your marriage? When did you get married?
Well, we got married in 1968 in the fall, at the same time we graduated from Stanford and went to work. I think it was 70 that I began producing that show I was telling you about, live in L.A., and we had been doing other reporting in 68, 69 to 70. In those 2 years, we were doing other reporting, and then I was working full-time on the Inquiry show, and I had been being a street reporter in that 68, 69, 70 time period. And
What was the reason in graduate school? Seems like your major field of study was communications.
Right.
Is there a difference between majoring in communications, majoring in journalism, majoring in broadcasting?
A huge difference. My emphasis was in documentary filmmaking. That's what I did for 2 years. And that documentary filmmaking, I was trained for 2 years at Stanford. It was an excellent program. It's still an excellent program. And we had to go out and raise our own money, do our own budgets, write our own scripts. We could choose to run our own audio or camera. I ran my own camera. We had to edit. We were working in 16-millimeter film. We had to cut our own negative. go to the labs. We had to do everything. So by the time that I graduated, I knew how to edit on a flatbed. I knew how to edit on an upright editor, which is what we had at KNBC. Everything was, it's hard for people to imagine today. But we were shooting in 16 millimeter with a Nagra quarter inch, and so the crews were had an umbilical cord between the camera and the audio, and there was a crystal sink running in the Nagra to the film. And the people listening who may once upon a time have seen the clapsticks come down in film, we all had to do that. And at every news story, everything we were doing, we were double system, and we had to use clapsticks so that our audio and our video, we could, film, we could match up. And it meant if you were doing two or three stories a day, which I was doing every day, and you would be having to go back to the studio from wherever you were, running to get the film into a laboratory for processing, running with the Nagra, with the audio tape, to another department that would transfer it to what's called full coat. Then you would be given, as a reporter, the 16-millimeter film and the full coat that had to be what's called synced up on one of these editors. And then
you probably have lost most of our audience when you about 16-millimeter. I seriously doubt whether any of the journalists out there today would even have a clue as to what you went through.
They might not,
about.
But there was a long time in which that was a very demanding skill, and for those of us who came through that, it made you absolutely, you had to be so focused and so disciplined because you, today, everything, and I mean, today I work on documentaries and work on TV shows and I work in Betacam SP or digital and the sound and the video are all together. But when we had to work, doing hard news, covering, things ranging from earthquakes to, things that were like the Academy Awards, and you were having to do it in double system, it was just another one of those disciplinary steps that made you so focused that you didn't waste any time because you had no time to waste. And you add all of that up from the time I started at Stanford in 66 and graduated in 68, went immediately to L.A. and started working in those big media boxes. It was a training that ended up in the long run making it able for me to be director of special projects at the CBS station in Denver when my husband left Harvard, and we went to Denver, and I became a director of the department there. And my job was to make 4 to 5 documentaries a year, do live studio programs, and do news segments. And it was in that context that in the September of 1979, 26 years ago, that I made my very first phone calls on a major phenomenon mystery that was occurring yet again. It had happened several times before and then began again that summer of 79 called animal mutilations. And there were hundreds and hundreds of reports in throughout the United States and Canada and Australia and Europe, and I had become aware of the phenomenon because an audio guy that had worked with me on another project that summer, having absolutely nothing to do with Earth Mysteries, it was a behind-the-scenes project at the Colorado Shakespeare Festival, and my audio fellow said, you know, I've just come off of a shoot for 2020 at ABC, and that was a brand-new show then. And he said, we shot, and he gave me this huge number of something like 130,000 feet, and again, it's 16 millimeter and quarter inch. That was double system, and it was such a huge number. And for those of us who worked in double system, that's why you were so efficient and so focused, because it cost a horrendous amount of money to buy film, quarter inch, process film, sync it up, and edit. And so you were so efficient in the use of the film. And when he gave me this gigantic number, and he said, you know, we shot this big project, and he said it was just so much film, and we were on the road. But Linda, the weird thing is, outside of these animals, we could never keep any batteries running. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, we would charge the batteries all night, and we would go out on a location where one of these animal mutilations was, and the batteries would be completely gone. And he said, and I mean, I charged 4 or 5 batteries. We started having battery belts flown to us, and they would all lose their power. Now
this was your introduction to Earth Mystery itself?
Yes, I'd never dealt with anything outside of medicine and environmental issues and nuclear issues and all of that. My entire life up until September of 1979 had been focused.
So that's where it starts. September of 1979,
right, with animal mutilation.
Linda dives into Earth Mysteries now. What did you do after you spoke with the individual, you're given the material, what happened next?
I called 2020 in New York, and I said, my name is Linda Moulton Howe. I'm Director of Special Projects at the CBS station in Denver. I have been talking with Mark O'Kane, who's been working audio for me on a film, and he says he's just done a big shoot for you for 2020 on unusual animal deaths. And I wondered, what's going to happen? When are you going to broadcast? And I was talking with the executive producer on 2020, and I don't know if that was Rune Arledge or who it was, but it was one of those guys right there from the beginning. And he said, an answer that was shocking then, it is shocking today. He said, oh, we scrapped that program. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, we're in the business of news, and we never could get a hard answer, so we're not going to do it. And I said, well, but you shot over 130,000. Yeah, I know, but we're not going to do it. And that was all I needed to hear. And I said, I'm going to get to the bottom of this.
That was an open door for your entire career.
Well, I'll tell you, when I think back, I really honestly do not... Well, I think what I want to say is I think there was a very, very special ingredient that was necessary for me to do what I did, and that was innocence. If I had had a clue where I was headed, where it would go, the Alice in Wonderland mirror I would pass through, how my life, my mind, everything would change, I don't know if I would have done it without the innocence. There is a...
That's a very powerful statement, Linda. Let's step back on that a little bit. September 1979. This literally launches you into Earth Mysteries, and along with that, you get launched into the oddball broadcaster, broadcasting on weird stuff.
No, not really. I did the film was a 9-month project. It was literally 18 hours a day, 7 days a week for 9 months without a single break. It was the most intense, hardest, longest project I have ever done in my life.
Where'd you get the energy?
Well, I've always had lots of energy, but I think that I was energized by the curiosity and the desire and the determination. I'm quite a persistent personality. And I
Did you have support from your family for this?
Well, my husband was in the same business and understood what I was doing, and I had a young daughter. I was gone a lot, and they knew what I was doing. So from that standpoint, but what I mean is that I wanted to get to the bottom of an answer to a mystery that was affecting animals around the world, and I really thought I was going to be able to do it and did not know that I would be stepping into quicksand that seemed to have no bottom. In fact, I wrote a chapter for a book for somebody, and I called it A Hall of Mirrors with a Quicksand Floor, and that's what I was entering when I began this investigation into the animal mutilation phenomenon. And at the end of those 9 months, A Strange Harvest, that was the documentary that was awarded an Emmy and several other accolades, was broadcast as a 2-hour special on the CBS station in Denver on May 28, 1980, and it got the largest rating that's ever been in that local station, ever. It was a 19 rating and a 37 share, blew out all of the network programming at the time, and I say this because this meant that so many people tuned in because they themselves had some knowledge about this subject, and that's what I learned. The switchboard could not keep up with the calls. They began dragging mail to my office in bags. We're talking 300, 500, 700, 1,000 letters within the first week or two. It was, to me, what I realized is, okay, I knew I was in a serious subject, and I knew that law enforcement, fellow journalists, ranchers, deputies were all telling me the same thing. Most of the time, off the record, we're dealing with creatures out of, from outer space. That's what everybody was telling me.
How did you react to that? What was your reaction when they would say that?
I think I was very shocked the first time a law enforcement officer said that with the camera running, but I had been hearing it off the record. And my challenge was, as a TV producer, I needed to have people on camera, and I was feeling extremely frustrated that I knew that I was in a subject that the government of the United States was lying through its teeth about, and it began to make me angry. And I think anger gives you a lot of energy. The subject I knew was real. The animals were real. The forensics, I began working with the few people who would work with me, having to do with what's happening to the tissue, what's happening to the soil, what's happening to the plants. And the more we learned, the stranger and weirder it became.
Did you get any hassle from the government itself over your investigation?
Big time by 1985, 86, and 87, but that's a different part of the story.
All right, go ahead.
We're now at 1979 to 80, and when this film gets broadcast, and it's my understanding, it was the first time that there was any television special that was ever done focused on animal mutilations, number one, and number two, law enforcement are the ones who spoke to the camera finally and made the link to what they call creatures not of this planet. And so when the film was broadcast, it was 2 hours from an Emmy award-winning, Peabody award-winning, I already had those awards by the time A Strange Harvest was broadcast, a documentary filmmaker who had was written about constantly in the Denver Post and the Rocky Mountain News for the TV work I was doing. So I, in contrast to what you were suggesting, it was not possible to marginalize me. I had been working in television for 11 years. I had won all of these awards, and I'm not saying that with ego. I'm saying that from the standpoint of the person who produced the two-hour A Strange Harvest, people had to take it seriously. And it wasn't Linda Howe standing in the film saying this. It was all of the law enforcement and the ranchers and all of these people that finally stood in front of the camera. So after it won an Emmy and it won other awards, I had to move on.
Was this the foundation for the Peabody Award?
No, I had won all of that before I ever did A Strange Harvest. I got the Peabody for medical and science productions that I did for the ABC station in Boston when my husband was working his way through Harvard. I'd already won so many awards by the time I did A Strange Harvest. And the thing about all this is that I had to go ahead, and as director of special projects, I had to keep producing all kinds of new subjects. I went ahead and did a film about the training of astronauts in Colorado called A Prairie Dawn. But this other huge mystery, this huge story, continued. And so I found myself living two lives. There was the one life that had to go on with doing new programs, all of the things of normal living. Then there was the other part who was getting all of these phone calls, all of these letters, photographs, videotapes, faxes from, I guess there wasn't faxes in 80, but I was inundated and kept up with the subject. And then 2 years after that broadcast was when Home Box Office came to me and said, we have seen the film that you produced, A Strange Harvest, and we would like you to contract with us to do an hour special for Home Box Office. That was in 82, and the contract was signed in New York on March 21st, 1983. That was the first serious branch, because in order to do the HBO project, I had to leave the so-called secure world of working inside of a TV station, as I had since graduating from Stanford in 68.
So you're kind of let loose.
Well, I let myself loose because I wanted to do the HBO project.
Well, by the time you got to that program, you have a long list of journal awards behind you, an absolutely fascinating career. At this point, when you dive into this kind of information, was it at this point that the government came into your life? I mean, I know at some point you had to have a hassle.
I had a big hassle. And this is after I contracted with HBO. And I write all about this in my first book, An Alien Harvest. I've done four books now, An Alien Harvest, a two-volume book called Glimpses of Other Realities that took 8 years to produce. It's about 1,000 pages between the two volumes, with about 500 images, documents, forensics, all kinds of things that those two volumes are really valuable, I think. And then
in terms of the audience listening, if they want to get a hold of one of these books, how would they go about it, Linda?
Oh, it's really easy. You go to www.earthfiles.com, and you'll be on the headlines page, and then look to the left. There is a menu. And in the menu, it says Earth File Shop. Click on there. It takes you to a page of all of my work, the documentary, the four books. The fourth book was Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles. And in the process of doing all of this work, and HBO being kind of the divider, meaning that I left from being inside of a TV station and went on my own so that I could work as an independent documentary filmmaker for HBO, that's where I was exposed to the alleged briefing paper for the President of the United States on the subject of extraterrestrial biological entities and their technologies.
Oh, tell us about that.
And people want to read in great detail and see so many photographs and documents, get my book, An Alien Harvest and Glimpses of Other Realities, Volumes 1 and 2. Now, the short form, because I know that we've only got so much time on the radio,
got 15 minutes left.
I signed the contract to do an hour special for Home Box Office on March 21st, 1983. We had a working title of UFOs, the E.T. Factor, and it was very specific. HBO wanted me to sort of go beyond where I left off with the A Strange Harvest and look at the E.T. Factor. If something from outer space was mutilating animals around the world in both hemispheres and had been doing so for a long time, who, what, and why? That's sort of where this hour was to go. And when I was in New York, I had a dinner meeting with Peter Gersten, who was an attorney, the first attorney in the United States who went through FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, at the end of the 70s, and filed...
He's very well known.
Yes, Peter filed FOIA requests from the NSA, CIA, DIA, NRO, the entire alphabet intelligence soup and military agencies, and that whole process of his on the behalf of Citizens Against UFO Secrecy, known as CAUSE, ended up going all the way to the United States Supreme Court on the denials from NSA, CIA, and a few others. And Gersten pushed it all the way to the Supreme Court because he would get cross-references. The NSA might say that the CIA had 121 documents while the CIA was denying that it had anything. and they and vice versa. And that's how, as an attorney filing these first requests, the contradictions and obvious lies were becoming quite transparent. When he pushed it to the U.S. Supreme Court, it was the famous in-camera scene in which the court ordered there was a release of documents from agencies in which 98% of the documents were blacked out. And that story made Time, Newsweek, the New York Times, everybody covered the release of all of these blacked out documents in the interest of national security. Well, now, so Gersten had been through that. I knew about it. And we have a meeting in New York the day that I have signed the contract to work on this project for Home Box Office. And Gersten says, look, there's a man named Richard Doty. He works for the Air Force Office of Special Investigations at Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque. He has sent me a document about an exchange of some kind of weapon, like a fight, between something in a UFO and a sergeant or some security guard at Ellsworth Air Force Base in South Dakota. He said, we Citizens Against UFO Secrecy, we would like to open this up. We would like to get more facts. If I set up a meeting, you can go to Kirtland, sit down with this Richard Doty, get the names and addresses and phone numbers of people who were involved. He said he could provide that. He said, then we at CAUSE, we will organize an investigative unit that will go to the Ellsworth area, and you can follow us in real active research, which is ideal. If you're going to do a really interesting documentary, you want to be following real stuff happening. Mm-hmm. So a meeting was set up. I go to Kirtland. I think I'm going to be there for 10 minutes to get some names and phone numbers and be out of there and on my way. And instead, this man, Richard Doty, his opening line to me in this big office at the AFOSI building, you know, that documentary that you did, A Strange Harvest, really upset some people in Washington. You broadsided.
Good.
And then he said, my superiors have asked me to show you this. You can ask me questions, but you cannot take notes. And I want you to move from the chair you're sitting in, which was right in front of his desk. And then he pointed to this big, large chair that seemed strangely in the middle of the room of this huge office. And as he said those words, he handed me several pages typed. And the top said, briefing paper for the President of the United States of America on the subject of unidentified aerial vehicles. And as I sat down into the chair I was being assigned to...
You had to be stunned at this point.
Oh, I was. I was completely disoriented. Why was this happening? And as I began reading, some of these paragraphs are basically etched in my mind forever. Clearly, words are as clear right now in my mind as they were sitting there. And it opened up with a paragraph about crash retrieval operations by the United States government from approximately 8 different locations that included two Roswell, different Roswell and different years. 47 and 49 were on the list. Aztec, New Mexico was on the list. Magdalena, near the plains of St. Augustine, was on the list. Kingman, Arizona, was on the list. And a place south of Laredo, Texas, was on the list. And then it went into descriptions of these entities, and it went into a paragraph that to this day, I have thought about actually two of the paragraphs, but this one I'm going to say exactly as it was in that paper.
These
extraterrestrials manipulated DNA in already evolving primates to create Homo sapiens.
Oh, wow.
On the last page of this document, picking up that theme under what was called Project Garnet on this document that I was given. It said, all questions and mysteries about the evolution of Homo sapien on this planet have been answered, and this project is closed.
For them, at least for public closure.
The implication is that Cro-Magnon Homo sapiens sapien, the current hominid humanoid on this planet that we think of as human beings, is the manufactured android for somebody else, and that there's been a whole series of them, that the whole hominid history on the planet is something that has been the product of manipulation of DNA in model after model, and that somehow the genetic harvesting from the animals plays some role.
Is this, Linda, do you think this is one of the reasons why the government says nothing, because the impact of this information on religion, et cetera, would be so horrendous to cause literally chaos within our own system?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yes,
yeah,
it is the story that once you begin to find out what the underbelly is of the UFO, the animal mutilations, the human abductions, and on, and you begin to realize that this is not a story that anyone wants to be true in the way it has unfolded to the so-called modern human mind. And
let's bring this
one thing that's really important.
He's
passed now. But he was a military man that I was allowed to talk with. Well, he made himself available, let's put it that way. Because he was aware of my research. And he said to me, after he had told me about his own firsthand experience with what was called an Eben, he said, Linda, he said, all of this is stranger than anyone could ever imagine. No husband can go home to his wife. No wife can go home to her husband and talk about any of it. It is too bizarre, and it keeps itself secret. It's all so strange. It's not what we wanted. The Spielberg idea of a lovable creature that could make us laugh and was vulnerable is what everybody would like, that we would sit down around the table and we would learn about the universe. Or, hey, I want to go on your spaceship. I want to go out to see what Mars looks like from your craft. Well, everything that I've learned is that we're not going to be able to sit down and have coffee with these entities.
Are we lab rats, Linda?
To a certain degree, I think that's a fair characterization, but before we go off tonight, I would like you and the listeners to know that there is a force in this universe. I think of it as the difference between an artificial leaf and a real leaf. You can tell that difference. All you have to do is feel an artificial leaf and a real live leaf, and you know that difference. Whatever that difference is, don't put it in a box or a name. Just say it is a force, and it is a force of life. I am convinced from my own long experience of being out there at the edge, hanging by my fingernails in mysteries in which there was no net, nothing safe, that there is an allyship with a force that for me is positive, is hugely positive. And that whatever we're dealing with when it comes to the so-called extraterrestrial biological world, it is in the same universe with the rest of us. That life force that I have found to be such a positive ally is there for them as well as for us. What all the agendas are, I cannot lay out, but if everybody is trying to survive, if all the issues relate to survival, then ultimately maybe we will all have compassion for what has happened.
Well, it's an amazing story, Linda. First of all, it's affecting me right now personally at a very personal level. And I'm not talking about a religious type of impact because I'm pretty neutral on most of that. But at a personal level, it's hard not to move away from the concept of, is this ongoing? Are we, in fact, laboratory rats? And if this is true, what motivation would these extraterrestrials have for all of this? I mean,
survival.
Why? How does it affect their survival?
That's what we're all trying to find out. I really do think at the bottom of every single direction you go, it's survival. Our survival, their survival, Earth's surface life survival. It's a big, complex problem. I think that there's a series of issues. And
so,
I think our government caught on. And then they decided that it was not a story that they would ever know how to tell.
There's no way to approach the subject without putting anthropomorphic words and statements to the beings that we're talking about. So I'm just going to do it. Is this, in your opinion, a benign approach to survival? In other words, I'm saying they are not malevolent. Would that be a correct assessment?
It is a good question, and the best way I can answer it is there seems to be a lot of types and a lot of agendas. And there also seems to be a bell-shaped curve, if you know what I mean by that. That
yes,
there
I
is
do.
A wide range here of whether things seem to be positive or negative. And that in the middle of the bell-shaped curve, there is a bigger area that does not seem to be either positive or negative. And that what we're dealing with, some of it may have a very, very specific interest in our survival. And many others may not care. But when it comes to a big question about biodiversity of life, I believe that we're dealing with intelligences, no matter what their ultimate agenda, who do have respect for and actually feel that there is a preciousness about biodiversity, and that what we're doing on the planet in terms of the highest extinction rate. This is the sixth mass extinction rate, and we're responsible for it on the Earth right now. We are killing species off at a rate that is staggering. This is not helping the Earth, because biodiversity makes all life stronger. The more life that is killed off, for whatever reasons, the weaker the planet becomes and the weaker life becomes. Somewhere in there is the crux of one of the issues. What is allowable to do with life? What must happen on this planet to turn it around so it is not headed in a path of extinction? This
well, apparently you don't feel as if we've already passed the point of no return.
I don't think we have. No, I do not think we have. I really do feel that things are hanging in a balance. That consciousness itself can make a difference. And one of the, I guess you would say one of the sad ironies of all of this, I have learned to feel sadness and compassion for Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Harry S. Truman, who were clearly, totally aware of everything we're talking about in terms of an off-planet presence. And they came to a decision, and it may have been the right one, that they had no way that they could bridge to the world that was coming out of World War II, to what they were learning about extraterrestrial biological entities without panic. And then you set up a condition in which governments have decided unilaterally this will never, ever reach the public until... And here it is, 2005. This is still considered the subject that is off limits, politically unacceptable, no one is supposed to discuss, and yet may be affecting more things on this planet than we would ever know. I would be shocked. And the sad irony is that these people who have made these decisions in our government probably did so thinking they were super patriots. Many are gone, long gone, and they made all of these decisions in the interest of national security to preserve our ability to function. The sad irony is that now we're in the 21st century. We have a planet that is in trouble and in crisis in the environment in many, many ways, and that out there, and perhaps underground, are other intelligences either monitoring, aiding, interfering, a whole host of things, and the government is now in such a box that it's created for itself, almost like a Chinese torture, that if they now try to tell the truth, at a time when the environment of the planet is precarious, what will happen? If they had told everybody what they were learning back in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, maybe the whole population of the planet would have grown up with all of the things that the governments were learning, and it would be a different world. We'll never know.
Are we mature enough, Linda, to accept this kind of information at a public level?
I don't think that that can remain an issue much longer. I think it is high time that the surface life of this Earth woke up to the fact that we are not the only intelligent life in this universe.
You recently gave a speech, a talk in Hawaii, and also Amsterdam. Did you present any of this information?
Oh, yeah. This is the first year that I have been trying to present a big box that the formal title of my presentation is UFO Crash Retrievals, the American Government Policy of Denial in the Interest of National Security. And it began with leaked information to me from a political representative in the state of New Mexico. And his leaks came from the Naval Research Laboratory and people working at White Sands Missile Range. And his leaked information came to him in the 80s. He talked to me about it in the mid-90s. And I finally, 10 years later, with his permission, took that information combined with new document releases that build a huge picture that we were trying to shoot this technology out of the skies as early as February of 1942. And that is in documents exchanged between Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his Army Chief of Staff, George C. Marshall. Those are documents that no one has refuted, that they are out there and they are discussing the interplanetary and celestial nature of the objects that came down in the San Bernardino Mountains and in another place that is not specified during the quote-unquote Battle of Los Angeles on February 25th, 1942.
Linda, let's step back for a minute. As a researcher, looking at all this, all the information you have, all the evidence, I mean, it's enough to blow anybody away. The question on my mind, and probably others also, is since there is so much evidence, and since this obviously does exist, is there a reason why these extraterrestrials themselves do not make themselves publicly known to the masses on the Earth itself?
Excellent question, and it is the question that has made me nervous for 26 years.
Ah, well, what kind of answers might Linda come up with when she's not talking on public radio and she's just musing over in her own mind? What would she say?
Go to my books, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volumes 1 and 2.
Touché.
Truly, the complexities of all of this and why it is so difficult and why I have come to feel sad compassion for the people who have been making these uneasy decisions about keeping the public and the media at an arm's length distance from every single thing in this subject. Probably in the beginning, they wanted to buy time. They wanted the technology. They wanted to know what they could do with it. And here we are, these many decades later, and they're still trying to buy time. And one man told me, he said, Linda, there's not a single person who has worked in or for Majestic 12 on the extraterrestrial problem who wants to be alive when the story breaks, quote unquote.
Well, we all want. I want to read something to you. You, quote, you are certainly on the road less traveled, but then that is why we follow your work and reporting and have for many years now. It's a lonely road and one that only people with integrity can travel for very long, end quote. Now, Linda, your entire career has been a marvel of courage and conviction. Tell me, in an age where most reporters are only willing to pass on a party line, how have you managed to maintain your reporting integrity? What is it about Linda Moulton Howe that keeps her path in sight and you don't yield to the pressure to conform? Tell me, what is it about you that does that?
If my mom were here, she would say she always wanted the truth. Pure and simple. I want to know the facts and the truth, not political spin, not a policy for our protection. I want to know the unvarnished truth. I have a huge curiosity. I always have had. My life and my path to me have been defined by those simple ingredients. I wanted to explore the universe through the stars in a telescope when I was 3 years old. Through telescopes, I have been able to look out, but nothing in a telescope brought me as close to an unvarnished truth about other life in the universe as starting out in those pastures trying to find out what was happening to all those mutilated animals. And that in and of itself is so bizarre, because to come into the truth and the anomalies of animal mutilations worldwide and find that on the other side of it, the real fact, not satanic cults, not predator, not disease, to have law enforcement tell me many times to my face, no, those are just reasons that we give the media to keep them off our backs. They know that's not what they're dealing with. And as an investigative reporter and that child that I always was, who always wanted to know what was the truth beyond the edge of the telescope, it is exactly the same thing that when I started walking those pastures, I just really wanted to know what in the world could be doing this to all of these animals and why. Today, I can say to you with great certainty, extraterrestrial biological entities are involved with the worldwide animal mutilation phenomenon, which has been going on since at least the 1940s, if not centuries. The government knows it. If they admit their knowledge, then what happens next? Because governments are supposed to be responsible for protecting us. What about all the ranchers who have lost so many animals and so many dollars?
Well, the government cannot come back now and say, oops, sorry, we had to keep it quiet for a while, but now this is the truth. I'm not sure anybody would believe them anyway at this point.
Well,
would know what to believe.
And then that comes back to your question. Why is it that one or more, because we're not dealing with just one, why is it that one or more of the non-human entities, that's the phrase that most government people use today, NHEs, why is it that one or more do not act themselves? Why is it that there isn't a disclosure? It would become a forced disclosure on the planet if the political power centers of the planet did not act, and the non-humans did. Why don't they act? Why don't they appear?
That's a good question, and it's driving me a little bit insane as we talk, because I can't help but think, with all this going on for so many years, us being a product of their DNA manipulation, there goes the creation story, why aren't they actually doing something to make them make themselves known? Also, I'm starting to wonder, considering what you've said, it does sound a little bit like some of those entities as groups may in fact be competitive with each other. In other words, they're not all working towards the same goal.
I think that's a fair statement.
Well, let's jump. We went over time, and that's fine. The interview has been absolutely fascinating, Linda. I don't know how to thank you for, first of all, the revelations that you made on the show tonight. There is one thing I want to jump to. A recent investigation of yours. You, on your website, you talked about the Wayland Smithy and Woolstone crop formations.
Right.
Now, one of the things that was fascinating was that apparently some Australian scientists jumped into the whole arena of crop circles, did a mathematical analysis of the crop circles. My conclusion after reading on your website is that he concludes there's some sort of miscalculation of the Mayan calendar. Rather than ending in our year of 2012, it in fact would end in 2007. Is that right, or did I misinterpret?
No, not really. He found that in the Wayland Smithy and the Woolstone, those two patterns, and in fact you have to go to the Woolstone, they're both incredible. They were very close to each other. And it was in the Woolstone that he found a clock. And it really is a clock. And I tried to illustrate that at Earth Files by taking Photoshop and making yellow dots where the tick-tock, tick-tock is going on in the formation. Now, literally, you don't have wheat that is moving around. But what you find, and he's the one who discovered it and pointed out, that there are, in these patterns in Woolstone, blocks of standing wheat. They are the same small clump as they move. If you think of a Mayan, a very specific Mayan border pattern, and you turn it into a circle, inside of each of 16 sections inside, so think of a clock that instead of 12, it has 16 numbers. There is this moving clump of standing wheat that is moving through 16 points on a clock. And when you look at it and your mind sees it and you realize that of the 16 clock numbers, two of the numbers repeat, and I believe that was what should have been 3 to 4 repeats, and what should have been 15 to 16 are totally blurred, or they're not there. And he raised the question, what would that mean if you could understand all of the math? Why is it that 15 to 16, the clock deliberately stopped? Well, when he worked back, he found not to the exclusion of December 22nd, 2012, not excluding that. That's there. That is the date that is the end of what is called the Mayan Grand Calendar that is over 5,000 years old on the night of December 22nd, 2012. It is the end of that calendar. It has been thought of as a possible point of catastrophe, annihilation, everything negative, to redemption, a new dawn, a new age, everything in between. Well, what he found working in the math of this clock is that two dates in addition to 2012 come up. August 2007 and 2010. he thinks, the Australian scientist thinks, that this, the Wollstone and the Wayland-Smithy, that they go together, they're very complex, and that they are forewarning us of events yet to happen before 2012.
So the dates, mid-August of 2007
and
the year 2010,
right.
Are you saying you yourself, Linda, expect some sort of cataclysmic event on those two dates?
I'd be very honest. I have no expectation. I try to be as positive in my life as I possibly can about everything. I am holding out in my own mind that link to the force that has been there with me since I can remember, that we are going to move into a period in which it's going to be reforming, I hope, contact with other life, that there is not going to be annihilation, that we are not heading toward an apocalypse, that we are, in fact, moving toward some kind of revolutionary new time when I hope the planet is finally more honest with itself. And that's where I am. That is my personal, honest answer to you. I cannot, though, as an investigative reporter, I cannot ignore or exclude all of the other interpretations of the Mayan calendar coming to a close in 2012 as possibly relating to some kind of catastrophic event. And I think the most interesting that I've heard came also from a scientist. This is government insider stuff, and you never know if it's misinformation. You don't know, but it's interesting to contemplate. He said it was his understanding that we have finally become aware that there are cycles of energy releases in our galaxy. We're talking galactic, not solar system. We're talking beyond our sun and planets, and that what could happen in 2012, marked on a series of cyclic events in the Mayan grand calendar, because they had knowledge from extraterrestrials who knew that the entire galaxy has cycles, that one of those cycles will be a burst of energy from the galactic center in 2012. That will have some kind of an effect on the entire galaxy. What will that be? I have not a clue.
We have been having recently mega solar flares. About a week or two back, we had four or five X-class solar flares.
Nine.
There's nine.
Nine, okay. X-class flares between the X-17 on September 7th and September 19th. In 12 days, we had nine X-class solar flares. And if you go to earthfiles.com on the headlines page and you just scroll down past, I think there's something about the hurricane, but I think right there I have the story about my interview recently, fascinating, with one of the NASA solar team leaders who is trying to study the solar flares, and said that this truly is a puzzling time. This is supposed to be solar minimum. And
yeah, solar minimum.
You're right, and we are and we do. The sun does have an extremely low number of sunspots. Now I'm going to give you another startling statistic, which is what astonished the solar physicists and why they had a meeting this past Wednesday to discuss all of this. All nine of the X-class solar flares between September 7th and September 19th of 2005, every one of them came from the same sunspot, known as 808 in September and known as 798 in August. They have never seen anything like that before. We have had multiple flares from multiple sunspots. These gigantic flares came from one sunspot. They don't understand it. And right now, one of the most interesting things going, as we go into 2006, there is a bet. Money wagers are being placed among solar physicists' teams. Some solar physicists are saying that we are headed in this next solar maximum, which is supposed to top out when? Between 2010 and 2012. They think that this is going to be a gigantic solar maximum with flares going off all the time, with sunspots, how it will affect our GPS systems, all of our high frequency, all of our satellites, that we could be in for one heck of a ride just in the next 7 years.
This would take out all our satellites.
Depending upon the direction of a release of a solar flare, if it's head-on with the Earth, it could take out satellites on that side of the Earth, yes. Now, the interesting thing is, and maybe it is a good way to close out this program, that even solar physicists in the 21st century can't figure out our sun. There is a whole other group of solar physicists, and they're dealing with similar data. They are convinced that out of this strange solar minimum that was so active, that what's going to happen is that we're going to move into a solar maximum in which there will be no sunspots and no flares, totally the opposite. Now, if you jump back to 1645 to 1720, in those period of years in the world, astronomers noticed that there were periods where they couldn't see any sunspots on the sun. That is when Europe had what was known as the Little Ice Age. Some solar physicists are actually proposing the possibility that instead of moving into a heat-up mini-catastrophe, that we could be going the other way into cooling.
We're going to wind up all needing new and heavier parkers, is what you're saying.
Well, this is how strange right now the Earth is at the end of 2005, when you realize we only have 3 months left and we are going to be celebrating New Year's Day of 2006.
And I have an idea. New Year's Day itself is a Sunday. Is there any possibility of getting Linda back on the show for that day?
I know that this coming holiday I won't be around, so I know that I couldn't do it then, but I'd be more than happy to do another show with you after we get into January.
Oh, fantastic. And Linda, I really enjoy the freewheeling style where you're covering from A to Z. Absolutely fantastic. On a lighter note, before we end, I would like you one more time to give out your website address, and also you have a subscription of some sort you haven't mentioned.
Oh, yes. In Earth Files, I was explaining, yes, it is a news website that is separated. I cover news in science, environment, and real X-Files. And it has a gigantic archive going from 1999 to 2005 with about 1,000 reports in it now and 10,000 images.
The part that
is subscription at Earth Files is the archives, to have access to this enormous archive and to the real X-Files, because somehow I have to pay the bills at producing and reporting earthfiles.com. But the science and the environmental reports are always freely accessible for 120 days, that's 4 months, until they are archived. So there is a subscription for access to the archives and to the real X-Files. But, you know, it is such a small fee, and I think that the material in it is not quite like anywhere else in the world.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm absolutely positive. Okay, one last question, and then we have to wrap up. This has absolutely nothing to do with the Earth Files. I want you to make believe for a minute that you're standing on a high school stage. You're talking to young people. You're talking primarily to the young girls out there that want to go and follow your path. What would you say?
have courage. Yeah, it's taken a lot of courage, but it also has taken a lot of innocence and a lot of persistence. And probably if you said, what is the one ingredient in my personality and my makeup, in addition to the genetic gift from my parents of having a tremendous stamina and energy, it is persistence, never, never allowing no to be the answer to anything, that you can always go another step further. You always can, and you must, if you are going, if you're going to try to get to the bottom of Earth mysteries, you have to learn how to persist.
Well, Linda, I want to thank you for the interview tonight. It was absolutely fascinating. You have me riveted to this microphone. I could sit here and speak with you for hours and just pick your brains.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Linda. And to the audience, good night. And we will have Linda back sometime after the 1st of January. Thank you very much, and good night. Thank you, Linda.
Thank you, Nevin. Take care. God bless you in your radio effort.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Good night. And that ends our show for tonight. Again, it was a fascinating journey into the realms of forbidden knowledge. Until next time, this is Nevin Campanella wishing all of you health, happiness, and a safe journey on your chosen path. Good night.